Have you ever wondered about the giant trash pile near I-85, or why there are painted structures across from Piedmont Middle School that look like subway station entrances? Or where have all the canker worms gone? Vote for the question you'd like us to answer in the next episode of the FAQ City Podcast by going to WFAE.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. For so many Americans, presidential elections tend to focus on who will capture the White House here in America. But for a professor at UNC Charlotte, the contest for the presidency is in his home country of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and it is of special interest because he is a candidate for that nation's highest elected office. Mirsad Hajikadic is a professor of software and information systems at UNC Charlotte and serves as the founding executive director of the university's Data Science Initiative. A UNCC faculty member since 1987, he previously served as the founding dean of the College of Computing and Informatics from 2000 to 2008. But it's not just in computer science that he holds his degrees. He earned a Master of Public Administration in Government from Harvard University. He is taking a sabbatical to run as an independent candidate for one of the three spots on Bosnia's tripartite presidency. Welcome back, Dr. Hajikadic, to Charlotte Talks.
Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
My first question is rather a simple one, but maybe it's fairly complex. Why are you running for the presidency of Bosnia and Herzegovina?
Because I think this is the office that can... It is the most visible. And then I believe that as an independent candidate, this is the position that I can... from which I can influence the country the most and push it a little bit toward the better days.
Okay. We want to get more into your thoughts about running for that particular
sure.
office, but I want our listeners to have a better understanding of your home country. I believe when you left to come to the United States, it was still Yugoslavia.
Correct.
It was still very much a communist state.
Correct.
Give us a sense of what was life like under communism in the former Yugoslavia.
And every time people say communism, it has a harsher connotation than what it was really like in Bosnia, in Yugoslavia in those days. Yugoslavia was considered more of a socialist than communist country. For example, we had a passport and we could travel wherever we wanted to. It is true that it was harder to be somebody with a position in a company, high position in a company. It was hard to be a CEO of a company if you were not a member of the Communist Party. Okay. However, outside of that, politics was really not considered a big deal. Football was number one. European football was the number one activity.
So soccer.
Music,
okay.
The soccer.
Okay.
And so, but... it was also a non-aligned country, the country that didn't want to be part of the East or the West, and together with India and Egypt formed this non-alignment movement. Mm-hmm. And with that, probably opened many markets in Asia and Africa. So life was not really bad. I did not feel pressure to become a member. Religion was suppressed, that is true. It wasn't forbidden. But it was suppressed in the sense that if you were openly religious, you would not be able to occupy a high-level position within a company or in a society or certainly within a party.
Okay. Why did you decide to come to the United States?
I wanted to get educated. I was thinking about a PhD program, wanted to do a PhD in artificial intelligence, applied for a Fulbright scholarship. That was the only way to really be able financially to afford it. They accepted me, funded it for 1 year, and it was the Fulbright Foundation that found the Southern Methodist University in Dallas as a place for me, and that's where I got my PhD.
What was it like going from Yugoslavia to Dallas, Texas?
Yeah, it was so interesting. You know, at that time, the TV show Dallas was really popular. And that was our impression of the U.S. Everything had to be like Dallas, right? And then we showed up, and it was, yes, it was really, it was rich and life was full and wonderful, but in one part of Dallas, okay. The Highland Park and the southern part of Dallas. But if you were moved outside of that environment, then you would find a different kind of life. So it was sobering, but also enriching, and it was wonderful.
Okay. As part of the Balkans region of Eastern Europe, Bosnia and Herzegovina is very much a multi-ethnic and multi-religious land. Can you give us a description of what and who makes up that region?
We talk about Bosnia, right?
Yes.
So Bosnia has about 4.1 million people. It has a diaspora, people living outside of Bosnia, of 1.2 million. And of that 4.12 million within Bosnia, I believe that roughly 50%, maybe 50.1, are what they call Bosniaks, who are Muslims. There is about 32-33% Eastern Orthodox. They call themselves Serbs, Bosnian Serbs, and about 12% now Catholics, and they call themselves Bosnian Croats.
Okay. All right.
Now, there are others as well. There are minorities, there are Jews, Romas, but they are minority compared to these three nations, peoples.
Following the death of the longtime Yugoslavian ruler Tito in 1980 and the eventual collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, Yugoslavia eventually broke up into six republics. And in 1992, Bosnia declared its independence. What was it like to watch the breakup of the former Yugoslavia and the formation of this new nation of Bosnia and Herzegovina?
It was painful. I believe that many people regretted that fact.
Why?
Yugoslavia was a successful country. We did not know it then. Mm-hmm. Many things about socialism bothered a lot of people. We did want to have democracy, absolutely. And we wanted to have maybe even better economy, sometimes even more personal freedom, because many things were carefully vetted and prohibited. But still, it was in some sense much more just a country than any of the six republics are, who used to be, or the countries who used to be republics of Yugoslavia. So, and to tell you the truth, Tito was considered a tyrant by many in the world, but most people in Bosnia didn't look at him that way, because he was the one who got these six different kinds of republics or people to get together and form something larger. He was a dictator, absolutely, but more benevolent than anything else. For example, he did not promote corruption. Nobody from his family was in any high position. We did not even know his children and what they were doing. And he was capable of keeping the lid on the nationalism that has been present for the longest time.
Okay.
And was the reason why Yugoslavia went through some tough time in the Second World War.
Right. After this formation of the new Bosnian nation, it led to the neighboring Serbia Republic to work with Bosnian Serbs to try and reclaim some potential territory under Serbian control. And as described by the United Nations, it led to what was called the deadliest of all disintegrations of the former Yugoslavia. There was ethnic cleansing of Bosniaks and Croats, the establishment of concentration camps the first time since World War II that had been seen on European soil, and such intense violence, such as in July of 1995 in the town of Srebrenica, a UN-declared safe zone. The massacre of 8,000 Bosniak men and boys led to the event being classified as genocide during the Bosnian War of 92 to 95. In the end, an estimated 100,000 people were killed in the three-year-long war, and another 2.2 million citizens of all ethnicities were displaced. What was it like to watch those horrific events unfold in your former home country?
So at that time, I was already here in the United States. And what I did, I watched it on TV. CNN, everything else, and tried to get as much information as I could. We tried to be helpful and maybe send some help, bring some people over here. And for us, it was the sense of powerlessness that was the most hard to deal with, because you could see what was happening, but you couldn't do really much. And I knew a lot of people who lost a lot or almost everything. I had my my own parents who took them forever to get out of the city of Banja Luka, which is in northwest Bosnia, who was at that time occupied by Serbs, who just to get out of the country with the using International Red Cross transfer capability or transport capability to come here. So we could see what was happening. We could also see the inaction or action of the world, depending on the day. And at the same time, we could see how the lobbying groups were trying to influence the events. Also, it was hard to see how the administration, let's say the U.S. administration, is trying to figure out what to do and how to stop it. And the United States was considered the most positive, most constructive member of the world community in trying to deal with the conflict.
And certainly after the war, the labeling of war crimes that was committed, NATO had launched a bombing campaign against the Serbs in August of 95, and the parties finally came together in Dayton, Ohio, for a round of peace accords that were signed in December of 1995. How has the Dayton Peace Accords been working in the country since 95?
Yeah, that's a great question. Initially, it's been working wonderfully well. It clearly stopped the war and allowed the people or peoples to start working together, actually forced them to work together. There was one thing in the Dayton Agreement, Annex 4, which today is the constitution of Bosnia-Herzegovina, that assumed and established, actually, the Office of High Representative, who has what we call Bonn's powers, signed in the city of Bonn in Germany, that allowed him to actually rule the country completely as a sovereign or as a dictator, if you will. And initially, Lord Petty Ashton was the high representative, was using those powers to calm down the nationalist rhetoric and forces. And Bosnia, within 6-7 years, became one of the top 20 destinations for investment in the world. Really? That, since then, has changed tremendously, substantially.
How so? Is it the rise of nationalism?
It's the rise of nationalism again, because they started using other provisions of the Dayton Agreement to basically say, oh, what about us, our special interests? The Dayton Agreement has never been officially translated in the Bosnian language, and people are now using poor interpretations to introduce categories that were not intended to be there.
Okay. We are going to be talking more about certainly the aftermath of the Bosnian conflict, the Balkan Wars that went on, along with the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia that just wrapped up last year, and then also talk about your candidacy for one of the three positions of President of Bosnia and Herzegovina. We're talking with Mirsad Hajicadic, a professor at UNC Charlotte, who is a candidate for one of the offices of President of Bosnia and Herzegovina. This is Michael Bitzer, and this is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Welcome back to Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're speaking with Mirsad Hajicadic, a professor at UNC Charlotte and who is a candidate for one of the positions of presidency of Bosnia-Herzegovina. We were talking about the end of the genocide conflict within the Balkans, and in the first time since the Nuremberg and Tokyo war trials following World War II, the United Nations established the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in 1993. It ended last year after 161 individuals were indicted, 90 were sentenced, and 19 acquitted. What has been the reaction to the tribunal and the verdicts in Bosnia?
It's been mixed. There are these three, I'm going to use the term because that's what they use it back there, constituent nations. And that's the thing that they didn't really translate well from the English version of the Annex 4 of the Dayton Agreement. It talks about people who live in Bosnia. But in Bosnia, they interpret the term constituent peoples as nations who form Bosnia-Herzegovina, and therefore they have special interests, and there are three of them, Bosniaks, Croats, and Serbs. The reaction to the tribunal in The Hague is mixed and different based on the nationality, the nation, or the peoples you're talking about. Croats and Serbs, for the most part, think that this is not fair and that therefore everybody did exactly the same thing and therefore everybody should be punished equally, despite the fact or in spite the fact that the number of victims tell a different story. Bosniaks welcome the fact that people finally pay for the crimes that they have done. But also there are some people who are from the ranks of the Bosniaks who are also at The Hague or were at The Hague. However, the numbers are really disproportionate because the crime was disproportionate. So when somebody is at the end, when they serve the sentence and they go home, the Croats and Serbs welcome them as the heroes. And that is the part that continues the war. Nobody won the war, and this is an attempt to win the war in peace.
So it would almost depend on which perspective you're looking at it, Bosniak, right. Croat, Serb, to say, was justice served or was justice not served by the tribunal?
That is absolutely true. We have different views. The problem is the current politicians who are in power are nationalists on all three sides, and they are using that as a rallying cry as a reason to promote the cause. And they are basically saying, look what they are doing to our people. Only we can protect you, therefore come to our side. And therefore the justice and what happened and the history is being misinterpreted. And different histories are told in schools today, depending on which part of Bosnia you are from or you live in.
So is this politics of nationalism kind of the defining characteristic of what you are going to be entering into in this campaign?
Absolutely. People or their students, people who participated in the war, committed crimes, or their students are in power again. And so whatever was happening in the 90s is happening today as well. And this is exactly what I will be facing today. And this is why I decided to run, to basically introduce a different discourse, political discourse, to basically tell them that there is no way they can build a country based on nationalism and fear.
When was that moment that you decided to make this decision to run for the presidency? I mean, it's not something we say here in the United States anybody can run for the presidency, but you decided to make that decision. What prompted it?
Yeah, there was one moment when a friend from Sarajevo called me and said, and that was in September or October of last year, and he said, Mirsad, I don't know if you ever considered being involved in politics in Bosnia, but if you ever did, this is the moment, because we are going through elections in 2018 in October. These might be the last elections in Bosnia as we know it, because if these nationalists assume or gain power again, they will tear it apart. There are clear
literally
indications
they
will
the
really
country.
Divide a country in three parts, one joining Serbia, one Croatia, and what you have is a little enclave that Bosnia really dominated, but like Palestine in the middle of Europe, what we have today in the Palestine. So he said, if you really thought that you might be interested, this is the time. And given the fact that I have, over the years, looked at the ways to contribute and help, and I was the founding president of the Bosnian American Academy of Arts and Sciences, of the advisory council that is educating members of the U.S. Congress on the events in Bosnia, and was behind the two resolutions in the U.S. Congress and one and the Bosnian caucus in the U.S. Congress. I thought maybe this is, and I went to Harvard for this reason, to understand how societies really work and how you make them better, how you define policies. I thought maybe this is a sign. Maybe I really should. I talked to up to 10 friends, family members. They all said, nothing can be done. It's cemented. Votes are divided along the nationalistic lines. Unless you look at this longer term, right. then if you want to start a movement, then possibly. And that's exactly what I want to do. I want to change the discourse. I want to introduce another possibility. I would like to give youth a chance. I would like to give those who think differently a chance, a platform, a way to get behind something and say, let's make the change. And that is exactly why I decided to do this.
Unlike the United States, which has a single president, Bosnia's government is headed by a tripartite presidency. We talked about it. Three individuals who collectively are the highest elected officers, executive officers. Explain this office. How did it come about? And why was this three presidency created?
Right. This goes back to that concept of constituent nations. And I think this may be the only place in the world that has that concept. And it is absolutely unacceptable. I don't know any developed country that would accept this democracy, this type of democracy, because you have people who can veto anything that's good for the country just because it's not good enough for them to put them in the special position compared to everybody else. And the same thing is in the Senate. We have something like the Senate and the House. Mm-hmm. It's a two-body democracy when it comes to the Congress. And it's the same thing. Regardless of the percentage that your people have, your nationality people have within the country, you have one-third of the seats. Those three have one-third of the seats, three-fourths. And the last fourth is for everybody else, except for the presidency, where only these three, as they call them, constituent nations, and I don't know what it means, because they're constituent peoples, not nations, because nation is Bosnian, Bosnia-Herzegovina nation. And they basically gave them for the presidency a seat. So in this presidential council or tripartite body, there is one representative of the Croats, one of the Serbs, and one of the Bosniaks. Unfortunately, and there is a lawsuit, if you are Jew or Roma, Bosnian Jew or Bosnian Roma or Bosnian anybody, mm-hmm. you cannot run for president. You can vote but cannot run for president because there is no one for you or your group of people. Yeah. And worse, if you declared yourself as a Bosnian, refusing to accept this division based on religion, you don't have the right to be a member of the presidency.
So do all Bosnians vote for all three candidates, or is it again separated into just the Serbs vote for one officer and the Croats for another? How does that work practically?
The country is divided into two parts. They call them entities. One is Serb-dominated, and it is called Republika Srpska. The other has mostly Bosniaks and Croats, and it's called Federation or Federacija. Yeah. So for the Bosniak and the Croat member of the presidency, only people in federation or federacija can vote. Only them. They cannot vote for the Serb representative in the presidency. For the Serb member of the presidency, only people in the Republika Srpska can vote. So even if you are Serb in the wrong part of the country, you cannot vote for your representative. And if you are Bosniak or Croat in the wrong part of the country, Republika Srpska, you cannot vote for your representatives on the presidency. It is an apartheid.
It sounds like it's badly divided and only makes the division and the polarization. We talk about polarization here in the United States, but it sounds like it's even worse in terms of actually creating the institution and polarizing it within the institution itself.
Exactly. It is when you look at the Dayton Agreement, and the President Clinton the other day said the same thing. It did serve the purpose. It stopped the war, but introduced the mechanisms that prevent the country from moving on and moving forward. Because any one of these constituent peoples can stop the progress. And everybody's trying to basically get as much for themselves as possible. And they hope the other two, other than the Bosniaks, they're trying to maybe separate, they actually take part of the country where they are dominating force and join the neighboring republics of the Serbia or Croatia. And so the mechanisms are built in to prevent Bosnia to succeed. Everybody's trying to maximize their rights at the level of constituent peoples, not the country, not the citizens. And therefore, we have a problem.
In a Bosnian publication that I hope Google Translate got correctly, you said that Bosnia is a country where, quote, politics is extremely dangerous and dirty. I guess my question would be, how so, and what is your campaign platform for running for the presidency?
Right. You know what? Recently, UNC Charlotte had a feature on me, and in the process, they also contacted General Wesley Clark to ask about the politics in Bosnia, and he basically said it's a mafioso-style politics, and it actually is. The people who are in power are so corrupt, and they were the cause of corruption and supported and maintained it. And some of them did some criminal activities. They are really afraid to lose because, A, they would lose the sources of money, and, B, they might go to jail, actually. So they are ready and prepared to do anything and everything in order to stay in power. Now, character assassination, that's expected. That's a norm. And they will find witnesses for things that never happened, but doesn't matter. They'll find it. And people will believe it because of the fear that they introduce. There's a possibility of physical danger, right? Because, you are on your own, and they'll do everything, as I said, in power to stay in power. In the neighboring country, the prime minister was killed several years back. So there are forces who are still using this pretext of war for their own personal gain, and they will stop at nothing. Now, what's my platform? My platform is really just threefold. One, we have to make the Bosnia functional again in terms of, or functional, period, because it is not right now. It is not right now because people are trying to maximize the parties that represent these nations or nationalists. They are trying to maximize things at the level of parties, and they assume many of the prerogatives of the country, of the state. So my thing is, let's think of the whole country first. And if a law that you're introducing is not contributing to the country, it should not pass. If it's not contributing to the well-being of the citizen, it should not pass. And I'm trying to wake up people to basically not vote for the nationalists, to get engaged in the politics, to run for offices, and basically say, yeah, we want to think of Bosnia first, not in terms of external sense, but internal sense, Bosnia first, to maximize what it is that we need to do for the good of all of us. Second thing is, let's get the economy going and moving. If we don't have jobs, nothing else really matters. And clearly in Bosnia, unless you're a member of the party, you cannot get any job. They are actually choking the whole country. You have to listen to the message of the party, be on the message in order to get any chance of the prosperity. And the young people, that's the third element. They are leaving in droves. About 700 young people leave Bosnia on a daily basis because Germany will accept all of them. They need highly qualified workforce.
So in attempting to overcome this kind of singular nationalism, depending on what you identify as, and thinking more broadly about the country as a whole, that sounds like a high hill to try and overcome, to really have a sense of we're all in this together, as opposed to we individually, we Serbs, we Croats, we Bosniaks.
Right.
How do you overcome that long legacy?
It is really hard because we spent about 23 years doing this. There are actually, you have schools over there. There are under one roof in the city of Mostar, two schools, one Catholic, one Muslim, or one Croat, one Bosnian. And they don't even mix. And they have different histories, and they have different curricula. Mm-hmm. And so they are, they are educating and forming people to be nationalists and to hate. It is hard. However, when you look at the fact that only 48% of the people voted in the last elections, it means 52% did not. So I'm trying to get those 52, or at least a larger part of them, to say, yeah, we want to vote, because there is now, we have somebody to vote for. They are not voting because they are, it's a protest vote. Mm-hmm. It's apathy. We cannot change anything if they want to really do it. When I talk to people, the people I talk to, they are not nationalists. They are normal people. They would like to actually have a better country that's working well economically, that everything is fine. I think there is enough people to think differently. I just need to wake them up.
It sounds like a lot of what is going on here in the United States, and we'll talk a little bit after the break about the relationship between Bosnia and the United States and what some of your specific plans are for the presidency. This is Mirsad Hajicadic, and I'm Michael Bitzer with Catawba College, and we'll be back. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Welcome back to Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. And we're talking with a candidate for the presidency of Bosnia-Herzegovina, professor at UNC Charlotte, Mirsad Hajicadic. We were talking before the break about the level of antagonism in Bosnia at this point in its politics,
right.
And that a lot of it stems from the kind of nationalism. Would you consider religious conflict within that kind of nationalism as well, or is religion more to the side and it's just pure national ethnic perspectives?
I believe that it is a land grab sort of policy, and they just use religion as a way to get people excited, identified, labeled. Serbia always had the desire to be greater Serbia, and the same thing is for Croatia. Before the war, the two leaders, Tudjman and Milosevic, Milosevic from Serbia, Tudjman from Croatia, made a deal in a little town or village or whatever it is, Karađorđevo in Serbia, to divide Bosnia. And basically what played out afterwards was exactly that, except that Bosniaks rised up, and many from the Bosnian Serb and Croat communities joined the Bosniaks to defend Bosnia.
So it's very much kind of an identity politics going on within the country.
It is, except that they are defining identity in a single way, as you have to be either Serb, Croat, or Bosniak. You cannot be Bosnian. And they, in the process, they are destroying the possibility of creating the identity that always existed, which was the Bosnian identity. And they don't know that people can have, or they don't want to know, that people can have multiple identities. It is okay to be Bosnian and a Serb, right? But let's build a country in which we can all live better, and then be whatever you want to be. It is fine.
So how is your presidential campaign going to help to achieve that? You talk about wanting a kind of moderate approach to stabilizing the nation, to keep it from slipping into disintegration. How is your campaign, how would your presidency hope to achieve that?
I'm hoping that I will give a chance to or voice to young people, and there are some indications that many of them are actually getting more interested in voting for the first time. They rarely vote. Young people rarely vote.
Much like here in the United States.
Okay. Also, people from diaspora, people who live outside of Bosnia and Herzegovina, because they don't vote. First time after the elections, 460,000 of them voted. Last time, last elections, only 37,000 voted. They gave up on changing, possibility of changing the political structure of Bosnia. Also those unhappy, unsatisfied. You know, it is interesting that if you give them a different way of thinking, some of them actually will come over, and 2 months into it, there are people already who are using my vocabulary, even though they're coming from different parties, which is really what I was hoping to accomplish.
Okay. How many folks are going to be running? How many candidates are there?
Total will be probably around 20, except the Bosniak side is always the most populous. There's probably going to be 12 or so candidates on the Bosniak side, and then there's Serb and Croats, maybe 4 or 5 on the Serbs. Three or four on each Croat and the Serb side.
Okay, and if you're a voter, you go in and you select a ballot, and you have to vote within your identification, or how exactly is the average voter going to show up and make this decision?
Yeah, well, they made it so streamlined that now even you have to vote for the straight line, party line. You almost, they prevent you from picking and choosing candidates, party line. And therefore, they are even trying to limit who can vote for whom, even within these two halves. For example, Croats within Federation are saying you can only Croats can vote for the Croat member representative, not the Bosniak and Croats. And the same thing for the Bosniak side. On the Serb side, anybody can vote, but it has to be a Serb candidate. And you know what is happening now is much like the United States, not like the United States, but it's going down that path in the following sense. Over there, everybody's trying to maximize things at the level of the party. Nationality/party. And I think in the last maybe 5 or 6, 7 years that I see in the United States, and I came here in 1984, I'm seeing that people are trying to do things that are, if it's good for the other party, I'm not going to vote for it, even though it's good for the country. I'm not going to vote for it. And I think that is really dangerous. We have to keep fact or be mindful of the fact that country comes first, no matter what. It doesn't matter which party I belong to. And we need to realize that the world is going to change. You know, Bosnia, in some sense, is almost like indication of what's coming to the world, because Bosnia is diverse. Many countries of the world are becoming more diverse. Mm-hmm. Nation state used to be defined as one nation, one language, one country. That is changing. Look what's happening in Europe, in France and Germany. They are becoming, with Syrian refugees, they are popping up a lot of issues in all the countries. In France, with the people from Algeria and Morocco and who are different, but they want to be French, but they have different religion and they look differently. All the societies are in sorts of upheaval. Nation state is going away. We don't know what to replace it with. The United States, we hear, there will be no majority in 20, 30 years, no matter how you define it, white, whatever it is. And so we need to figure out how we live together constructively for the benefit of all of us to make this country better and better every day.
Are there lessons from what you have seen in American politics, this kind of increase in the polarization, the willingness to only adhere to one's political party's perspective? Are there lessons that you can take away and hopefully use in your campaign back in Bosnia.
Right. Well, there is one thing that's wonderful about the U.S. is that, first of all, its constitution is probably the most advanced in the world. And is the tension there is between the federal authority and the state authorities. It's not between different kinds of people, right? And I think that's how I'd like to take the Bosnian and say, listen, we shouldn't really set aside quotas for representation of anybody. It's one person, one vote. And whatever the majority in that group thinks, that's going to be the number of seats who belong to that kind of opinion. Of course, there's a danger with any democracy, which is the possibility of tyranny of the majority. Oh. And there's also the possibility you have to protect minorities. And you need to figure out how to do it. Every situation is different. I would like the Bosnia and Bosnian people to look at the Constitution of the United States and try to figure out if we can do as much of it as possible. But at the same time, it is true that democracies are producing tough situations throughout the world. Let's say, look at Turkey. You have almost dictatorship. Something similar is happening in Hungary, in Poland, Russia. And so these democracies are, while wonderful, they are producing the possibility of some kind of tyrants arising through them and misusing the system. That is a dangerous situation everywhere, and it's on the rise in the world, and we need to be cognizant of that. And that's one of the reasons I look at Bosnia as not as a special case, but almost an indication of what's happening in the world and could be a lesson for the rest of the world. If we can solve Bosnia properly, there could be a message to the Europe and the rest of the world how diverse multinational societies could or should be arranged.
Is the danger of this nationalism growing into authoritarianism? I mean, we've certainly seen that in Russia. Very hard right parties are in power in Poland and in Hungary. You mentioned Turkey. Is that a possibility if things continue potentially on the path and you're not elected to the presidency? Could an authoritarian type of regime come to power?
Well, right now in Bosnia, most Bosniaks would accept Tito again or somebody like Tito. So they're convinced that the people themselves are not capable of producing a society that will converge and work for the betterment of everybody. They believe that a strong person is required to make them do so. I don't agree with that. But it is the expectation, and they've lived through one and the other. They've lived through not the non-democracy, which was under Tito, and through democracy, which led to genocide and war and now corruption and dysfunctional state. So they're saying, wait a second, compare one to the other. The other one, we had peace, and I was doing fine. Right. Not perfect, could have been much better, but better than this. So you have those tendencies. In Bosnia today.
Unlike our presidential campaign season that seems to run literally for 4 years, in fact, Donald Trump recently appointed his campaign manager for a re-election bid in 2020, you have to compete in a very compressed schedule. I believe the elections are in October. Explain a little bit of what you're going to be doing between now and October in comparison to what you have experienced here in the United States.
Sure. So October's elections will be October 7th. You can actually campaign, pay for campaigning, use money to campaign, meaning for advertisement and so on, for 2 months only.
For two months only.
And there is a week of a quiet period before the actual election. So August, September will be really the most active period. And people are saying that the most money is being spent the last 10 days before the election because people have short memory and they remember only the flood of information and ads in that time. But right now what is happening is, for example, we are given until May 25th to register for election to the candidacy. Mm-hmm. So I need to collect 5,000 signatures. And I need to also have $15,000 roughly. and prove that I have residency over there to be able to run. So that's right now is the biggest activity, the most important activity is to find enough people who will say, yeah, we think this guy is sort of cool. Mm-hmm. We'll sign, let him be on the ballot.
Okay.
And then trying to get some money in order to get the quota to be able to run. So that's the activity number one. And after that, I'm going to have to visit every part of the country to let people know about me, because I am not a member of any party for a reason. I wanted to run as an independent candidate, and I know I made it harder for me, but I wanted to run as an independent candidate to say I don't agree with the politics thus far, whether it's nationalist or it's the left or center-left. Whoever assumed the power behaved the same way. Therefore, not really interested in that. I would like to start a movement, which is hard, meaning I don't have access to funds that they have. I don't have access to the media that they control.
Right.
So I will have to physically visit every village, every town, do town hall meetings in order to convey my message. And the message is, come on, look at what they are doing to the country, to you, to your children. We can do much better than this.
What have you taken away from American-style presidential campaigns that you might see to do in the very short, compressed time period of campaigning there?
Yeah, I've been here long enough to, and I've participated in all the elections, but long enough to notice that these campaigns are getting actually dirtier and dirtier. They're more about personalities than about issues mm-hmm. in the end. And I'm not sure I like that, but that's what politics in Bosnia is as well. Campaigning in Bosnia is about, it is always about the other person, what he or she is not capable of doing, rather than let's talk about issues. I'm afraid that I'm going to have to do it. I really don't want to. And I told them I'm not going to make comment on any other candidate. I'm going to talk about issues. But it will be hard. But the United States politicians have perfected this science, honestly. Of course, there's a ton of money. There's a lot of money. But even the message and how you look on TV and elevator speech, the slogans. It's amazing. There's nobody like U.S. politicians. And there's industry behind them that mm-hmm. just think about the one-liners that they will use in different environments. And shaking hands, I read the book by Tip O'Neill, who basically said, you know, there are two rules. You have to really shake every hand and ask everybody for their vote and their money. And if you don't, you will not get it.
How has your campaign been received so far?
So far, it's been marvelous. I was on the national TV on January 12th, where I announced my candidacy, and I had no clue what the response would be. But I have to tell you, within 2 hours, there were about, 8,000 people who shared the video of that performance on YouTube, in addition to 50,000 who watched it, plus diaspora, maybe 100,000. And it's a small country, right? So in 2 days, 30,000 people actually shared it and viewed it. Social media is big over there. 33,000 young people sent them an email saying, not only that I'm going to vote for the first time, thus far I have never voted because I had never had anybody to vote for, but how can I help? It's been tremendous, actually. It surprised everybody. So we'll see.
Okay, we've got less than a minute to wrap up the show. If you are elected, how long would you serve?
4 years, and you can be reelected one more time. And because it's three people, every 8 months, one of them presides over the committee of presidents.
Okay. And if for some reason, we're not saying that it will, but if for some reason you're not elected, will you come back to the United States or will you stay in Bosnia?
I'm planning to come back unless there is a substantial number of people who voted for me and I would have to start a party or a movement, really.
So you would see this as a potential long-term investment in the country. You've talked about that this is a responsibility.
If the response is good enough, I'm going to look at it long-term and create a party.
Mirsad Hajicadic, a professor at UNC Charlotte and a candidate for the presidency of Bosnia-Herzegovina, thank you for your time and best wishes for the election coming up.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm Michael Bitzer, and this is Charlotte Talks.